So what do these celebrities have in common? Arthur Ashe, John Denver, Milton Berle, Warren Zevon, John Ritter. Yeah, they're all dead. And the last days of their lives are all profiled in a new book by Mitchell Fink, longtime celebrity journalist. He's got a new book called The Last Days of Dead Celebrities, and I welcome him to KMOX this afternoon. Hi, Mitchell.
Nice to be with you, Paul.
Nice to have you on here today. You talk about those, and I guess it's almost a total of 15 people that you profile in this book and their last days. How many of these people that you profiled were responsible in some way for their own death?
Well, that's a great question. You could say, in a way, that John Lennon, maybe he was a little paranoid in his early years. Does that court death? I have no idea. Lee Strasberg, the great acting teacher, had a premonition about himself. John Belushi certainly was a drug addict, and everyone knows what happened to him. Orson Welles had a heart attack. I don't think he was expecting it. Lucille Ball, she was very sad in her last, really, 2.5 years of her life since the death of her first husband, Desi Arnaz, who died in December of 1986. She died close to 2.5 years later of a broken heart, I believe. Lyle Alzado certainly believed that he caused his own demise with the use of his steroids, and he kind of blamed his steroid use on the fact that he contracted brain cancer. There was no medical link to prove that, to back that up, but that's what he believed. Arthur Ashe was the unfortunate victim of a blood transfusion, and that's how he got AIDS. Margot Hemingway, certainly her death was ruled a suicide, so you can absolutely say she caused it, even though many of her friends to this day believe it was an accidental overdose. Tupac Shakur, who was gunned down, knew he was at some point going to be gunned down. He had been gunned down once before, and it didn't kill him, and this time it did. John Denver certainly was not expecting death. He was a very happy man at the time that his plane crashed. Milton Berle was very old and got sick and was telling jokes right up until the end. Ted Williams certainly knew he was ill, certainly knew that he did not want to be anything other than cremated, even though his son took it upon himself to create a phony will. And Ted Williams, as most people know, is in this cryogenics lab in Scottsdale, Arizona. His head is in one liquid nitrogen tank, and his body is in another. And interestingly enough, the son who put him there died in 2003, and now he's there too. David Blum could have sought help. You know, he's the NBC correspondent who died in the early days of the Iraq War on the way to Baghdad. He was in that Blum-mobile reporting on the Today Show and every other NBC outlet. He was suffering leg cramps. He called an 800 number that NBC has for all their reporters around the world. It's a medical hotline. He told the people that he had cramps. They told him what to do, which was get out of there. He didn't do it. He didn't listen. He was on the ride of his life. It cost him his life. Warren Zevon, unfortunately, had terminal cancer, even though he lived at least 10 months longer than the doctors said he would. And certainly John Ritter was in perfect health, seemingly, until his aorta ruptured.
You know what I find fascinating is, as you ran through those 15, there are some that were absolutely sudden, and others for whom anybody could have guessed that death was going to come fairly soon, whether it was because of age or because of overindulgence or whatever. But it's the Warren Zevon story, which you include as the next to last chapter in your book, that I found the most interesting, because here's a guy who got the word that he was terminal. And actually, they told him 3 months, didn't they?
That's correct.
And he actually lived 10. And he decided...
Actually, 13.
Oh, 13. Mm-hmm. And he decided, you know what? I'm going to go out in a... Not a blaze of glory, but I'm going to go out having the time of my life, right?
And he did. To the best of his ability, what Zevon did was, most people know that he recorded this album, which he actually lived to finish, A, B, to C, come out, and actually see it go up the charts. But the album is only part of what happened to Zevon and what he went through. And here was a guy who, if people don't know about Warren Zevon, he was this, you know, kind of offbeat singer-songwriter who wrote, you know, some great songs like Werewolves of London and things like that.
That's probably the song most people know him for, but he did so much more.
But much, much more. I mean, he was one of those singer-songwriters that other singer-songwriters admired. And so that's why so many artists, great artists like Jackson Browne and Bruce Springsteen, you know, were there with him to help him record this album. So, you know, so he did the album. He did David Letterman's show, which was like a tribute to Zevon, in December of that, just a few months after his diagnosis. And then, you know, he just kept on living. What happened to Zevon, because he had been, like a lot of people in the 70s, he was totally strung out for years on drugs and alcohol, and then he got clean. He got sober, and he completely changed his life. He didn't change how he lived or where he lived, but he lived drug-free and alcohol-free for many years. After the diagnosis, he decided, well, to heck with it, I'm going to start drinking again. And he started drinking again and started getting drunk and started taking every pill he could find and completely, you know, wanted to relive this rock and roll lifestyle. He played out sexual fantasies of his. He found willing participants, women and old girlfriends who were there to help him do what he wanted to do sexually. So here he was, you know, just the typical rock and roll lifestyle, even though he was terminal. But an amazing thing happened in Zevon's case. 2 weeks before he died, having seen his grandchildren born, having seen the album come out and rise on the charts, he suddenly, with 2 weeks to go before he died, stopped drinking again and sobered up again, mainly because, I mean, he knew he was going, and he wanted to feel everything going on in him, around him, through him, and he died really completely and totally on his own terms.
Tell me a little bit about that Letterman show, because that hour that he did with Warren Zevon, you could tell there was obvious love from Letterman for Zevon and a real connection there. And it turned out to be one of the most fascinating hours of television I've ever seen.
Well, yeah, but the backstory is even better, because in order, as most people know, Letterman does his show out of New York, and Warren Zevon lived in Los Angeles. So in order to do the show, Letterman did not go to Los Angeles. Zevon had to come to New York, and he was not well. He was sick. The cancer had totally spread and metastasized, and but they put him on a plane. They got him on a plane. It was a very, very difficult cross-country trip for him, even though he was riding first class. He stayed at a hotel in Midtown Manhattan and was really, really not well. They had no idea whether they'd even be able to prop him up to even do the show. To get him to the show was a major ordeal. But they got him there. He did it. And, you know, you never really would have known. Zevon was able to, you know, the red light comes on and suddenly you're on. And, you know, I mean, he was... you know, kind of like Zevon was, he was morbid even when he was well, you know.
Yeah.
So he was justifiably morbid and predictably, but yet Letterman had been such a fan of his that he just, you know, he just turned over the whole show to him, and it was great television, because you knew that this is a guy who's been given a death sentence. But, you know, I mean, Zevon really thought, you know, January, February, that would be it.
Right.
You know, and he wound up living to September and, you know, just went out in an extraordinary way and ultimately a peaceful way.
Interestingly, Letterman has refused to ever let that show be repeated.
You know, that may have something to do with Zevon's family, too. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, You know, I mean, it's the kind of thing that will stand the test of time, and I'm sure we'll see it at some point.
I hope we do. It's the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX, talking with Mitchell Finck about his new book, The Last Days of Dead Celebrities. Warren Zevon decided to go public with his illness, his mesothelioma. You also talk about Arthur Ashe in the book, and he went the opposite way. He didn't want anybody to know that he had contracted AIDS.
Well, you got to remember that Ashe, you know, in the 80s, by the time they found out that he had AIDS, it was full blown AIDS. You know, it was around the same time frame with Magic Johnson, which is like 91, and Magic Johnson contracting HIV had a chance, and we see that he's lived a normal and prosperous life and a healthy life because of all the medication that became available around that time. But when Ashe found out, it was full-blown AIDS because he had gotten the blood transfusion years earlier. So at that time, there was such a stigma about AIDS, and that he wanted to keep it a secret. Now, so the public and the press saw him getting thinner, and, you know, they kind of knew something was up, but he conveniently lied and had everyone around him lie for you know, some months. I thought it was interesting to do Ashe because of the issue. And the issue to me was, how far should the press go? How far does the press go? And where do you stand, you know, on the your own morality when it comes to delving into the private lives of public people, especially dealing with health-related issues? And I think it's an issue that is still a pertinent issue today. I know that if I, as a reporter, and I was certainly a reporter during those years, and I was a reporter for a long time for a number of newspapers, magazines, and what have you, TV stations, but you know, it's not the kind of thing that I might have felt comfortable going after. You know, here this USA Today confronted him. They said, "Hey, listen, you know, we found out you have AIDS. Do you want to confirm or deny it?" And he refused to do either. And he just wanted to buy some time, because at the time that they kind of, you know, got to him, he had still not dealt with his own daughter to tell his daughter that he's sick. And so his daughter was young at that time. I think she was 6 or 7 years old. And but he hadn't dealt with it. So here comes USA Today, and Ashe winds up, you know, calling a press conference for the next day, thinking a story is going to come out. And the truth is that USA Today actually sat on it and didn't run it. And then Ashe announced to the world he had AIDS. But I felt that the issue was still germane today. How far are we supposed to go in dealing with people, especially, you know, if he's not an elected official, you know, and he wasn't, he was just a tennis superstar. You know, who were we satisfying by delving into the health matters of a guy like that?
But what I find interesting, Mitchell, is that for a long time you worked with People magazine, and that's an outlet that glommed on to any celebrity being sick or dying.
Well,
as a
gossip columnist too, I was faced with that kind of, you know, moral dilemma all the time, and I had to make decisions myself. I brought my own morality to the table, and if I thought that it was pertinent, I went for it, and if I didn't, I didn't. And you know, I just think that that's the best that we all can do. There's no real standard. There's no real barometer. You have to create it as you go along. And I thought that issue was especially important. The reason I did Lyle Alzado, was because here was a guy, along the same time frame as Ashe, by the way, who was literally pointing his finger at the athletic community and saying, you know, you take steroids the way I took steroids, you're going to get brain cancer too, in so many words.
And was there ever any link proven there?
No, there wasn't. There was no medical link at all, but he sure believed it. Now, so there he was, pointing a finger at athletes of all sports, saying, you know, you better not do this because this can happen. And we see how they listened in the 90s, you know, and you look at, you know, some of the athletes who did not pay attention, and, you know, maybe they'll never get sick. You know, who knows? But I thought because he said what he said in 1991, and the issue today is still on the front pages of every sports section in the country, that it's worthwhile looking into.
I want to get into the last chapter in your book, which is about John Ritter. And I was very intrigued by the way you did this, because you tell it through the eyes of one of his best friends in the world, Henry the Fonz Winkler.
Well, you know, without the interview that Winkler gave me, I never could have really done justice to John Ritter, because Winkler was, for years and years, you know, one of the closest pals that Ritter had. And just, you know, coincidentally, that week, which is, if you can picture this, a day after Warren Zevon dies, Henry Winkler gets in his car in Los Angeles and drives over to Burbank because he's going to start rehearsals for a guest starring role in John Ritter's ABC sitcom Eight Simple Rules, which was now in its second season. And Henry Winkler, of course, one of the great, great sitcom stars in the history of television, as the Fonz in Happy Days, one of the biggest stars TV has ever produced.
And by the way, also one of the nicest human beings on the planet.
One of the nicest human beings on the planet. That's absolutely true. If we had more time, I would tell you some of my Henry Winkler stories, and I just... He's a great, great guy.
Yep.
A wonderful father, a great husband, and a wonderful man. Anyhow, and I've known Henry for years. I mean, you can't do what I did for a living and not run into people like Henry Winkler, and it kind of makes a lot of what I used to do worthwhile.
And considering you were a gossip columnist, that meant you dealt with sleazy celebrities all the time, and this guy was almost like a fish out of water compared to that,
you know,
right?
It's not a question that, you know, that some of them are sleazy and some of them are, you know, it's dealing with everybody in that community, and I did it based in Los Angeles, and I did it based in New York. But here's Winkler. You know, you would think, well, you know, he's going over to do this sitcom with his buddy John Ritter, that this would be like, you know, he could do this in his sleep. And in fact, he was petrified, apprehensive about this particular appearance, because it's not like starring in your own sitcom. You know, there's a rhythm to a show. It was already in its second season. As Henry described it, the characters were already clearly defined. And here he was coming in for one episode. And so he was very nervous about it. Now, Ritter knew that. So Peter Bogdanovich was also on the show that week. And so all Ritter cared about, because he was another great guy, by the way, and all he cared about was making his friends feel comfortable. And Ritter was all over the set that week, you know, making everyone else feel good. As a matter of fact, the director of the sitcom, a man named James Widows, had some tests at some doctor and, you know, thought he was having a heart problem. And during rehearsal, Widows was told that his doctor was on the phone, and Ritter heard this, and Ritter came running over. What's the matter? You know, is anything wrong? And apparently Widows got this clean bill of health, but here was Ritter totally concerned about everyone else. And then Thursday of that week, which ironically was not only his youngest child, Stella, her fifth birthday, but it was also September 11, and it was the second anniversary of September 11. And second or the first? I don't remember now, but I think it was 2002. May have been the first.
Yep.
No, it was 2003. I'm sorry.
Okay.
2003. So it was the second anniversary. And so suddenly Ritter doesn't feel well. And everybody thinks, well, you know, he must have eaten something, food poisoning. He goes into his dressing room to lie down, and he's feeling worse and worse and worse. Eventually, the rehearsal continued without him because, you know, there is a standard way you deal with a week of any sitcom. Monday's a table reading. Everyone started reading the script for the first time. Tuesday, it's going to get the thing up on its legs. Wednesday, they start really doing serious rehearsal. By Thursday, they're doing run-throughs. And Friday, these shows are taped in front of a live studio audience. And so they would, you know, ready to start doing run-throughs, and they were doing it with a stand-in, and everyone was told, well, John's not feeling well. He's not feeling well. And then they canceled the rest of rehearsal because he really wasn't feeling well. And Winkler went home not knowing that what was going on at all. And what was going on was a drama that was, you know, they drove him over to the hospital, which was very close by in Burbank, and in a matter of a few short hours, he was dead. And it was a shock, a complete shock. His aorta ruptured. It was called an aortic dissection. And Winkler got the call, you know, late at night, or he's ready to go to sleep, and they call him up and they tell him that John Ritter is dead. And all he knew was, you know, maybe it was something he ate. And you know, it was just a tremendous shock. Henry Winkler has never really gotten over it, and neither certainly is Ritter's family. They filed suit after Ritter's death, you know, that misdiagnosed and all that malpractice kind of stuff, and the hospital countersued, and the matter is still in litigation.
Great story. One of the chapters in The Last Days of Dead Celebrities, a new book by Mitchell Fink. We'll come back and talk more in another segment of The Paul Harris Show after this on News Talk 1120 KMOX. It's News Talk 1120 KMOX. Paul Harris talking with Mitchell Fink about his new book, The Last Days of Dead Celebrities. Just told a great story about John Ritter, whose death was a surprise, a stunner to people who knew him and people who just liked him or were fans of his. On the other hand, he also has a story in the book about Tupac Shakur, who foreshadowed his own death in his music, didn't he?
He sure did, Paul. He did not think he was going to live a long time, and of course he didn't. But, you know, I couldn't do Tupac justice, or any of these people in this book, without the right access. And in Tupac's case, his mother, Afeni Shakur, talked to me, and she had a remarkable story. I mean, here is a former crack addict who conceived him while she was incarcerated. She was a member of the Black Panther Party in her early in her youth, and but she had cleaned up her act, and she stopped doing crack, and she was really there for her son. But how she wound up letting her son go, because if you recall, in September of 1996, he was gunned down on the streets of Las Vegas. The murderer has never been brought to justice. Interestingly, all of the witnesses who came forward somehow are all dead.
Yeah.
Those who did not come forward somehow are all still alive. You know, you can do the math.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of the mother, because when Tupac was shot, he wound up going into a coma for a few days. And, you know, he lived 4 or 5 days after the shooting. And she was in Atlanta. She flew right to Vegas and sat vigil. And what she went through and the processes that she had to deal with in order to, you know, really ask that he be taken so that there was no more suffering, it was remarkable. And she was just very gracious with me. And I couldn't do these interviews without access. I needed people who were really firsthand witnesses, many of whom were, you know, as famous as the people who are dead. Tom Brokaw, who spoke to me about David Blum, the NBC reporter who died in Iraq. Yoko, of course, talked to me about John Lennon. You can't possibly do John Lennon without Yoko, and you couldn't possibly do Tupac without his mother.
You know, Tupac is a case of a guy living by the gangsta lifestyle and dying by the gangsta lifestyle. But you mentioned John Lennon. I was just in England on vacation last week and went to Liverpool for the first time and actually went inside John Lennon's boyhood home. The National Trust there has tours of McCartney and Lennon's childhood homes. And it was very odd for me reading your book when I came back to the States and getting to that chapter about John Lennon and reading about the end of his life, having just been where he had spent a good part of the beginning of his life. What was it that made him want to be a public figure again after 5 years? Because he was famously a house husband from 1975 to 1980.
Yeah, they called it his cocooning period, and but you know, he was a creative giant, a major artist who, you know, there's only so long you can sit there and do nothing if you have the kind of ability that he had. So slowly but surely, he came out of that period and was now looking at a brand new period. Now, Double Fantasy, the album that they recorded shortly before his death, you know, was never really given much credit from critics, and in fact it was not a huge album. I think he still would have had some great work ahead of him, but he was ready to go out, promote that record, and he did a number of interviews about Double Fantasy before he died, and he was all set to come out to the West Coast. I remember at the time I was doing a column in the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, and I started at the Herald Examiner as a rock and roll columnist. And so I got a call, you know, about 10 days before Lennon's death saying that, you know, John and Yoko are coming out. Would you like to interview them? And so I was all set. Their plans were to come to go to Northern California the next week for a few days and then drop down to L.A., and I was going to see them in L.A., and of course they never made the trip. But what was extraordinary to me was Yoko telling me a few things, namely that she felt this vibe in the air about something. Something seemed to be circling them, as she put it, and she couldn't identify it. She didn't think it was necessarily ominous, but she just there was something different about what was going on at that particular time. And interestingly, the last night of Lennon's life, he slept on the couch in his clothes. He had been listening to a song that he was mixing of hers, a song called Walking on Thin Ice. So she slept in the bed at the Dakota, and he was out on the couch. And when she got up in the morning, he wasn't in the bed. He had never got into bed and went out to the living room, and he was, you know, dozed on the couch with his clothes still on. And, you know, it's just kind of interesting. I mean, who knew that that would be his last day? But it was. And the fact that they did not sleep together that last night of his life, and, you know, the fact that she told me that, certainly to me made that whole chapter worthwhile.
Yeah, what I found most interesting in that chapter, and we're all out of time here, so we can't get into it here, we'll have to do it some other time, is how Lennon was wondering in 1980 if he'd be remembered, and whether his music, some of the greatest music ever written, would still be relevant in the future. Remarkable. I'm sorry we're all out of time. As I said, we'll get to it another time. In the meantime, let me get another plug-in for your book, because it is a terrific read, and we've only touched on 5 or 6 of the 15 celebrities that you write about in the last days of dead celebrities. Mitchell Finck, thank you for your time today. It's a pleasure.
It's been great being with you, Paul. Thank you.
It's the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.